You're listening
to a University of Kentucky
College of Arts and Sciences podcast. This podcast is from the 2013 Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky. In This Stars with Accents reading, moderated by Katarina Stoykova-Klemmer, writers George Ella Lyon, Sarah Freely, and Ada Limon read from several of their works.
I will invite to the stage first George Ella Lyon. George Ella Lyon's most recent poetry collections are The Many-Storied House, which was published by the University Press of Kentucky, and She Let Herself Go by LSU in 2012. Her other work includes a novel, a memoir, and a short story collection, as well as 37 books for young readers. She has received an Al Smith Fellowship, residencies at the Humbridge Center for the Arts, numerous grants from the Kentucky Foundation for Women, a Pushcart Prize nomination, and is featured in the PBS series The United States of Poetry. A native of Harlan County, Kentucky, Lyon works as a freelance writer and teacher based in Lexington, and we all adore her. Please help me welcome George Ella Lyon.
Thank you, Katarina. Thank you, Julie. Thanks to everyone who worked on the Women Writers Conference. It was such a joy. And I've been in Lexington since right before the Women Writers Conference started, and I really can't say enough about how it has fed my writing and my spirit over all these years. It's a phenomenal gift to this region and beyond. I had people in my workshop from California and Texas and New Mexico, and it's a great thing. My husband's just said this podium looks like a chariot, and now I've tried to figure out for years what it looks like, and it really does. So I should have horses. Where are they? I'm going to read from Many Storied House because it's new and I'm really excited about it. It's really a memoir in poems, and it's the story of a family in a house. And so when you open the book, you see a painting of the house, which was done by a boy in the neighborhood as a surprise for my parents one Christmas. And then as you go into the house, there are floor plans for each floor. So you can move through the rooms full of poems. They're not arranged chronologically, but spatially. So I hope this will invite you to think about your own dwelling places and the poems that are waiting for you there. Provenance. Here I stand at the beginning with more questions than answers. What I know is Papa built the house I grew up in at Rio Vista, which is down below Loyal, 4 miles from Harlan, the county seat. It's on First Street, number 108, I found out when we sold it. Fourth house on the right, two-story, reddish brown and white. You can't miss it. Door. Door we passed, will pass, are passing through. Threshold of our threshing, holding. Lintel of embraces, portal of goodbyes, our DNA clasping your handle. Passage. The morning Daddy was leaving for the surgery that would not save him, the doorbell rang and he opened to a jaunty man on the front porch, a familiar cadger who never paid back a loan. Tired of lies, Daddy refused and both men turned away, but a hinge in his heart turned Daddy back. "I'll give it to you," he said. It was the last thing the world asked of him, and he gave. So we've left the hall and we're in the living room. Art. When Daddy got that hi-fi which replaced the Crosley radio just inside the living room door, it came with a demonstration record to show what rich, lifelike sound Magnavox could bring into your home. Our neighborhood was bound by mountains, river, railroad. Coal trains whistled, rattling our walls day and night. But when Daddy turned on that hi-fi and the needle rode the black platter, we called the neighbors. "You've got to come hear this," we said, thrilled at the whoo and hiss and roar of a real train so close. Some of the poems connect the family story with the larger story in the world, and this is one of them. This is in the dining room. August 4th, 1944. My brother turns two, talking a blue streak. Hot as it is, mother bakes a cake, invites the grandparents down. First, there's spaghetti, which the toddler eats delicately by fistfuls. Then the shiny temple of cake. Everyone crowds around, singing to the future. To the future, they have pledged themselves, eight people hiding on the other side of the world. Then this day, the bookcase is swung back, stairway revealed. With shouts and shoves, they are herded out at gunpoint. All but one will fall to the final solution. But the Gestapo won't find the teenage girl's birthday gift, a red and white checked diary. The world will find that. There are more poems in the kitchen than anywhere else. Legacy. When they were tearing down the Bank of Harlan, somebody called Daddy to say he should come empty Papa's safety deposit box. Papa had been dead for years, and this was the first anyone had heard of his private hidey hole. Home from college, I was at the table that night when Daddy laid out the contents, a deed, a poem, a packet of Papa's love letters to Joe, and a pistol. All were spread on the table amid the remains of pork chops, biscuits, and gravy when the doorbell rang and I got up to answer. Friends, not close ones, happened to be in our neighborhood and stopped by. I ushered them down the hall to the kitchen where Mother had slipped the pistol off the table and under her apron. Daddy carried in chairs while I cleared the table, put on more coffee, passed a plate of Lorna Doone's. Poem, deed, letters lay unmentioned on the table while visitors munched and my pistol-packing mama sat frozen with that heat in her lap. There are poems in the garage. Then our house was in a flood, and the water was up to the piano keys. And there's a whole, in the flood happens in the middle of the book, and there's some excerpts from my father's journal in some of those poems, but I'm just going to read one. No light. As if to pay for what it took, the river left in the middle of the living room floor, a miner's orange hard hat. So my parents were out of the house for a year because there was an oil tank in the basement that broke against the joists as the river rose, and the house was soaked with oil. So, but they always had a New Year's Eve party, and they were going to have it in the house even if they couldn't live in the house. Threshold. They were determined to have their New Year's Eve party at home. Hell and high water having already come. Bring a chair, they told friends, since they hadn't moved in yet. The empty house was beautiful. New walls, bare floor shining. Card table in the kitchen lit by a hurricane lamp. How high did it get, Bob? Wallace asked, his hill house having stayed dry. Daddy put his hand above the kitchen radiator. Up to here, that's the magic line. A chorus of, yes, sir, the magic line. And it got higher than that at my house. Come midnight, this crew found the usual toast not enough. Out the front door they went to stand around the McFerrin's blue spruce, its deep boughs threaded with colored light. Hands linked, they sang, we'll take a cup of kindness yet, then went back in and did. I left out a kitchen poem. I gotta walk back a few steps here. This is called Over Coffee. I think if I'd been a man, Mother told me, I would have played football for Notre Dame. She was 88 when she said this. She could have done it too. Followed by Harvard Law and clerking for the Supreme Court. As it was, she had us. Family and house, PTA and heart fund, till my brother went to college. Then she ran the Chamber of Commerce from 1961 until she died. I think if I'd been a man, she'd never have sat at that table and told me all those stories. How her mother hit her with the butcher knife, but only the dull side. How she slapped her so hard it bloodied her nose. Mother needed to see her pain reflected in me so she could push it away. What do you think you'd have done, she'd say angrily, with seven little children, your husband gone all week, and you living at the back door of nowhere? Okay, so we're going upstairs. There's the upstairs. When my grandfather was going to build the house, my parents wanted a library because they were great readers. And so out over the garage, he built a room, and this is, we're going into the library now. On those shelves, from the landing, you step down into a room out over the garage. This is the room that made us who we were. Book lovers, scholars, people of the word, who found a safe place between hard covers. Deckle or gilt-edged, the wild world opened. Story, knowledge, emotion we'd been taught to hold in. On those shelves Papa built, into the wall below the windows, stood the many mansions of our house. And one other one in the library. Interior design. My mother decided my father never noticed anything in the house. To prove her point, she bought a packet of the plastic clay you use to hang posters and stuck a few items on the library wall. Above the couch, a matchbox, whiteout, a Kleenex pack, featherweight things. He said nothing. See, she told me, and stuck up an artificial rose and nail scissors. No response. Unbelievable, she said, adding scotch tape, pipe cleaners, brush rollers, one of the coin purses the cleaners gave away. Daddy just walked to his chair every night, dozing off halfway through the news. Finally, when the wall looked as though the plaster had broken out in junk, Mother took it all down. It's hopeless, she told me. But that night, Daddy said, "You know, I usually like the way you decorate, but that didn't look quite right." And now we're in the upstairs hall, by the laundry hamper. "Something happened," I tell my mother. "I am 5. That boy across the street, he did something that hurt. He stood above me saying, 'Bad, bad, you are bad. If you tell, they won't believe you. They won't want you anymore.' I ran away, but he trapped me in a room off the garage and hurt me harder." "Here," I say, "something happened, but I can't go back there." My mother sorts dirty clothes. She does not touch me. "You know that's not true," she says. "These are our neighbors. These are our friends. Nothing happened." This is in my room, toy chest. Betty the Beautiful Bride is shut inside. Dixon, Tiny Tears, Mabel Baby too. The bubble stuff I got when I got the flu. My Snow White coloring book, Old Orange Peel. My Gray Viewmaster with its picture wheel. Jump rope, tambourine, pail for sand. Comic book, magazine, little cake pan. Paper dolls whose blonde hair feels fake real. Plastic handcuffs and a crash mobile. In my brother's room. Off limits, my brother's room, because of the golden gun when I was 3 and he was 10. Because of the barbells when I was 6 and he was 13. And when I was 8, because of the shortwave radio he and Daddy built in the basement. And when he was 18, because he was gone. Sleepless. That night, in a froth of wrath, at Mother's refusal of the care I had set up for her, I couldn't sleep. I was leaving the next day. Was I leaving the next day? How could I leave if she wouldn't? How would I if she didn't? Things were fine as long as the caretaker was me. That's what she was saying. Then it was like a visit, until she could go back to work. But help? No, she didn't need help. I had no idea how awful I made her feel, calling people on the phone, setting up interviews. She couldn't endure another person in her house, never mind my life and work 3 hours away. I wanted to rip something to shreds, but had no paper. That's how far from myself I was. Staying in my brother's room, only a wall between her head and mine, so I could bolt awake if she called. I didn't want to wake her, creeping about the house, having her cough and ask, "What are you doing up?" So I opened the chest of drawers. Surely I would find some paper. Indeed I did. My parents' wedding announcement and Papa's death certificate. Chastened by a cosmic hand, I got in bed and snapped off the light. And there's poems in the yard. Here's one. D-Day. probably the nasturtiums whose stems and leaves she tossed in salads for a peppery bite were in bloom in the garden next to the hedge that June morning when she heard the news as she left the kitchen and went out with her basket of wash. Seeing her neighbor, old as her mother, hanging out clothes in her yard too, Mother called across the hedge, "Mrs. Mack, have you heard? Our troops have landed. The invasion has begun." At word of this mission to free the world from tyranny, Mrs. Mack replied, "I can't wait for Joe to come home and turn on the radio." All of it. This is the last part, and the last part of the book deals more with my mother's final illness, which was coming on in that other poem. On her side, when I told the healer about my mother's last day, the stroke, no neurologist to give the clot-dissolving shot, mountains fogged in, no airlift possible, no ambulance for long-distance transport. When I told her of my frantic drive back, cell service disappearing in road cuts around hills, trying to talk to the ER doctor whose true language was Hindi, trying to talk to my brother in Ireland. When I wept and said storms next morning kept the helicopter away till noon, then I chased it back to Lexington to find Mother in another ER on a ventilator, how they couldn't do more tests because something seemed to be happening. More strokes, heart stopped, code, shocked twice, a mountain range of beats. When I said, after doctor talks and more talks, I told them not to start my mother's heart again. And my husband and sons and girlfriend gathered round, then stepped out, and with just me holding her hand, life left, 24 hours after she was carried from her house. The healer said everything was on her side. And there are poems about taking the house apart, but this is after that. Thanksgiving night. After I'd locked the house for the last time, I kissed the door. Now, remembering, I feel my lips on my breastbone. And I don't know how many of you have ever had the task of taking apart a house. This was the only house my parents ever had. My mother lived there for 68 years, and it had everything. Our polio vaccination certificates, for example. But anyway, after it's all done, you can't believe it. You can't believe it when you're doing it, but you really can't believe it after it's done. And all these things keep coming back to you that you know, that are gone and that you had to deal with. And so anyway, there are blanks in this poem, so you'll hear the blanks. I can't believe that I gave away, that I left, that I kept. I can't believe nobody wanted or fought over or asked about all that that he collected, that she polished, that framed their life. I can't believe the boxes I carried in and taped together and filled and carried out, clothes, dishes, books, figurines, coins, clocks, every item in every drawer or cupboard or bookcase, on every shelf, in every closet, went through my hands, bent on taking apart what my parents put together, their home inside the house Papa built. And this is the last poem. Welcome. Late afternoon, I lie down for a nap, but instead of sleep, Daddy opens the door behind my eyes. He's in his shirt sleeves, standing on the carpet before the carpet before the flood. He reaches me into a hug, snug as bark. I didn't think you were here, I say. Yep, he answers, it's me. But Daddy, I start, it's all gone. Nonsense. How can the house be gone when we're standing in it? What time is it, I ask. And he laughs. No time. No time at all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Georgiella. Next, we'll hear from Sarah Freely. Sarah Freely is the author of A Brief Natural History of an American Girl and Sort of Gone, a book of poems that follows the rise and fall of a fictional picture named Al Stepanski. Her work has been featured in The Sun magazine, Brevity, Rattle, Barn Owl Review, and Tar River Poetry, on Garrison Keillor's Writer Almanac, and in the 2011 anthology Good Poems, American Places. Among her awards are a 2009 Poetry Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and a grant from the Constance Foundation of 2006. I missed the word there because I couldn't read it. Sarah lives in Rochester, New York, and this is her first time in Kentucky. Her chapbook, A Brief Natural History of an American Girl, won the Editor's Choice Award in the latest Accents Publishing Contest, and so I'm a very big fan. Please help me welcome Sarah Freely.
Thank you very much for that lovely introduction, and thank you, Julie, for everything you do. I talked to several of the conferees last night at the reception, and I think everybody had a really great time, so that's a testament, I think, to your organizing skills. And always thank you, Katerina, so much. This is actually my second time in Lexington. The first time I was here was in 1985. As in my previous life as a sports writer, I worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I was here covering the Final Four game between Georgetown and Villanova, which you can see on ESPN history as one of the, I think, one of the greatest basketball games ever played. Probably one of the greatest basketball games ever played that Kentucky wasn't playing in. I should probably correct that. But anyways, I sat in the second row of Rupp Arena and covered the game, so I'm really happy to be back here. I passed Rupp Arena on the way in. I'm like, ooh, wow, deja vu all over again. Another job from the past was as a waitress. Has anybody in here ever worked as a waitress or worked now as a waitress? Yeah, okay, she kind of know. It's kind of a really cool job, in that you can have absolutely no money and you go to work and you come home with, you know, like a fistful of dollars, which, you know, like isn't possible at too many jobs except for stripping or bank robbery, neither of which I could explain to my mother. But it's also a really hard job in that you have to take a lot from the customers that isn't always pleasant. You just sit there and nod and go, uh-huh. So in that way, it's like really good training for being in a writing workshop where you have to sit going, yeah, that's right. And, you know, like go home and plot the deaths of your the people that are in your group. Anyways, sorry. I'm actually reading from my book, but full disclosure, right before I left, I sat on my bifocals and broke them. So I had to bring my cheaters, and I can't see really well, so I had to, you know, like print out all my poems in like 14 point. So, and I still am, you know, like, so anyways, these are from my book, so I'm really, you know, like pretending to read from my book, but not really. Okay. This poem is Waitress, and it memorializes the time when I worked at a golf club. Waitress, Wednesdays, I waited on women golfers, endless four tops, just in from playing a hot 18. They drank gallons of unsweetened iced tea, demanded refills for free, and complained when the brew wasn't cold or strong enough. I ran on cans of tab, kept a lit Newport perched in the crotch of a black ashtray, lucky to get three deep drags between cocktails and order ups. The grill cook pointed a knife at me, threatened to cut off my tits if I didn't speak up. The bartender screamed at me for garnishing a dry Manhattan with a maraschino cherry. I leaned on the roll warmer and cried. No one paid attention. Every week, at least, someone untied her black apron and said, "Screw it," walked out in the middle of a shift, never to be seen again. I dried my eyes. In the 19th hole, men slipped bills in my pocket, eyed the V-neck of my uniform whenever I set down another round. An hour after my shift, I was shit-faced in a bar that didn't card me, paying for cold Molsons with quarters left by the lady golfers. I don't remember walking home on those nights, only the mornings when I woke to a wink of coins on the bureau, hours before I had to punch a clock again. I had nothing but time, and I was rich. I write many of my poems start in with exercises, and I belong to, you know, like a writer's group that sort of informally meets, sort of informally from time to time. And one night we blindfolded each other and, you know, like handed each other's things to stick into our mouths, edible things, which I don't recommend doing with anything but really close friends. So anyways, I got a stick of gum. So this poem came from that. It's called Sex Education. How is it I recall so exactly the clatter of film unspooling from loop to loop, the musk of perfume radiating from my wrists and throat, the warm gush of juicy fruit, the rasp of stockings as we crossed and uncrossed our legs, the heat in that room, a flock of girls cooped up away from the roosters, the almost men of our fantasies, who we dreamed would stand beneath our windows one day and crow for us as Romeo had done for Juliet. How we laughed when an army of sperm ejected from a cannon into a body of water where they swam or died, cartoon smiles disappearing in tiny peeps as one by one they drowned, leaving one last lonely sperm to swim up the long isthmus where the river opened to an ocean. And I still recall how the orchestra soared as he swam and swam toward the round ship of the egg, and how we stood and cheered when he docked, exhausted and triumphant, this tiny survivor, this sturdy sperm we would spend the next 10 years trying to kill off. And because of the stupid movie, I felt like a murderer each time I imagined him battering frantic and headlong against the barrier I directed down there, shouting, "Defense, de la defense," as he died in spasms of agony. And once, because I was drunk and didn't give a damn, because I wanted only to sink into the soft chance of carelessness, I let the whole bunch of them skinny dip without a death sentence of chemicals awaiting them at the end of their swim. And because I'd forgotten what my teacher told us that day after the film ended and the lights came up. Remember, girls, it takes just one. What chance did I have? They were as fit as Olympians, as cunning as spies. They came in formation, in armies, entire Caesar's legions, coming and coming and coming, always so many of them and one of me. I'm so old that they were film strips, I think. They didn't. Anyways, a sex poem must be followed by a smoking poem, I think. This one is entitled Old Flame. Decades after I quit, I still dream of lighting a cigarette, and even in sleep, feel my fingers curve to grip the filter tip of a Newport, recall the arc I traced, groove of hand to lip. Do I miss smoking, or the girl who smoked, who tucked a buck in the pocket of her cut-off jeans, so sure the world would buy her Jack and Coke? Or miss the men who lit me up, flick of thumb against greased wheel, first hit igniting tiny white lights, strung nerve to bone, clatter of engine, rev of cells, oh axons, oh dendrites. Donut delight. All summer I tossed wheels of dough into a sea of grease where they browned and crisped, while I smoked half a cigarette. By the time the owner stopped by, the air was humid with sugar, the bakery cases filled with rows of donuts I'd frosted and sprinkled. He'd pull a buck from his wallet to pay for his cruller, his cup of coffee, show me the photo of his son squinting into the light, smiling like a man who didn't know he would die at Quezon. On my last day, the boss pressed a wad of bills into my hand and kissed me goodbye. When he slipped his tongue into my mouth, I could feel the old dog of his heart rear up and tug at its leash. His breath tasted like ashes. He was my father's friend. I was 16 and didn't understand yet how life can kill you a little at a time. Still, I kissed him back. This is a relatively new poem, which is not in the book, so I'm honest reading it from here. A letter to you about myself. I still do bad things. Sometimes I bite my fingernails, not down to the quick, but only to even out the rough spots. Last week, my thumb snagged a new pair of tights. All day, the run laddered up my thigh, displaying beige leg flesh in each little window. I'm always in a hurry, an hour ahead of the here and now, a refugee from my own life. I hope I didn't give that to you. My teeth are bad. Maybe yours are too. My dentist says I'll be lucky to keep the teeth I have, as if he knows what my future will be, me in a hospital bed, cranked up high enough to see outdoors, the birds fighting for the last bit of seed in the feeder, the drone of a TV across the hall, a soap opera whose characters I no longer recognize. The names are the same, the actors different. Each day is like this. The girl who brings my tray is not the one from yesterday, though she says she is. Her hands are hard and strong. Here's your boiled egg, honey, she says. I don't answer to that name anymore. Wondrous. I'm driving home from school when the radio talk turns to E.B. White, his birthday, and I exit the here and now of the freeway at rush hour, travel back into the past where my mother is reading to my sister the part about Charlotte laying her eggs and dying. And though this is the fifth time Charlotte has died, my mother is crying again, and we're laughing at her because we know nothing of loss and its sad math, how every subtraction is exponential, how each grief multiplies the one preceding it, how the author tried 17 times to read the words, she died alone without crying, 17 takes and a short walk during which he called himself ridiculous, a grown man crying for a spider he'd spun out of the silk thread of invention. Wondrous how those words would come back and make him cry, and yes, wondrous to hear my mother's voice 10 years after the day she died. The catch, the rasp, the gathering up before she could say to us, I'm okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And now, Ada Limon. She is the author of three collections of poetry. Her most recent book, Sharks in the River, was published by Milkweed Editions in 2010, was named one of the top 30 books of 2010 by Cold Front magazine and called Complex and Wonderfilled by the Library Journal. Her second collection, This Big Fake World, was the winner of the 2005 Pearl Poetry Prize, and her first collection, Lucky Wreck, was selected by Jean Valentine as the winner of the 2005 Autumn House Poetry Prize. Her work has appeared in numerous magazines and journals, including the Harvard Review, Tri-Quarterly Online, Poetry Daily, and The New Yorker. She's lived in Lexington for about 2 years now, and as far as I know, horses are starting to sneak in her work, and also this is her first reading in Lexington, is that right? Please help me welcome Ada Limon.
Thank you so much. And those two readings were really beautiful, Georgella and Sarah. I'm going to read 8 poems. And just thank you so much for the to Katerina and to the Kentucky Women's Writers Conference, which has been a remarkable, remarkable experience. And so pleased to be a part of it. So yes, horses have snuck into my poems, and I'm going to start with a horse poem, but it's really a poem for girls. How to triumph like a girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy, like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger. After winning, ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies, as if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me, that somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart, giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge, beating, genius machine that thinks, no, it knows, it's going to come in first? That's true. I have a habit of, like, if I can't think of anything to say after a poem, I just say, that's true. It's a true story. That happened. When I was moving here, I was moving here with my boyfriend, which was both wonderful and terrifying. I had lived for 12 years in New York City, and I had lived very happily, gleefully alone for 12 years in New York City. So this was my first move in with a man experience, and, you know, it's going really well. He's not here. I don't even have to lie. So I'm telling the truth. But this is a love poem for him, and this is like what Adam Clay likes to say. This is what happens when poets write love poems. The last move. It was months when it felt like I had been washing the dishes forever. Hardwood planks under the feet, a cord to the sky. What is it to go to a wee from an eye? Each time he left for an errand, the walls would squeeze me in. I cried over the non-existent bath mat, wet floor of him. How south we were, far away in the outskirts, all the new bugs. I put my apron on as a joke and waltzed around carrying a zucchini like a child. This is not New York, and I am not important. This was before we got the dog, even, and before I really trusted the paralyzing tranquilizer of love stuck in the flesh of my neck. Back home, in my apartment, another woman lived there, in Brooklyn, by the deli, where everything was clean and contained, where I grieved my deaths. I took to my hands and knees. I was thinking about the novel I was writing, the great heavy chest of live animals I had been dragging around for years. What's life? I made the house so clean, shine and shine and shine. I was suspicious of the monkey sounds of Kentucky's birds, judging cackles, rusty mailbox, spiders in the magnolia tree, tornado talk, dead June bugs like pinto beans. Somewhere I had heard that, after noting the lack of water pressure in an old hotel in Los Angeles, they found a woman's body at the bottom of the cistern. Imagine just thinking the water was low, just wanting to take a shower. After that, when the water would act weird, spurt or gurgle, I'd imagine a body, a woman, a me, just years ago, freely single, happily unaccounted for, at the lowest curve of the water tower. Yes, and over, I'd press her down with a long pole until she was still. A love poem. It's true, though. Where I grew up in California, and we did not have fireflies, and I was amazed by them. And this poem is about that, sort of. I also, every time I say this poem is about that, it's never about that. Field bling. Nights when it's warm and no one is watching, I walk to the edge of the road and stare at all the fireflies. I squint and pretend they are hallucinations, bright, made-up waves of the brain. I call them field bling. I call them fancy creepies. It's been a long time since I've wanted to die. It makes me feel like taking off my skin suit and seeing how my light flies all on its own, neon and bouncy like a wannabe star. Right before I moved out of New York, I lost my stepmom to cancer, and was sort of amazed by how much it made me recommit to the universe and also change my life in a way that I was always going to follow the happiness and follow the joy. And this poem is called What Remains Grows Ravenous. I'm afraid that I won't do the right thing in the face of disaster, or I'm afraid I will be stupidly brave. I'll pull the helmet off the fallen when you're supposed to leave it on, in case it's holding things together. Also, I like to discuss my feelings too much. The only thing I've learned about a home death is that it requires a lot of washcloths. When we started to make a home together, he liked a lot of washcloths, the small, cheap kind for every day you're alive. Sometimes I would have dreams that she was still alive, and I couldn't find enough washcloths to help her, to clean her face, the tumors foul black spit up. I'd wake and fold all our new towels as neatly as I could and pile them in high piles so I could see them in case there was an emergency. What I didn't like was how people talked to me now that I was no longer single. They were nicer. Men who never looked at me would start up conversations like I was suddenly some safer form of fire. When my dad became a widower, women brought meals and wine and pies. The word widower looks like window, something you can see yourself in the dark. We fell in love at the same time, which seemed right but also wrong. Look at us living. They met at the same time, his and mine. I didn't realize it, but I was wearing my stepmom's sunglasses. His new love was stunning and kind, and I tried to imagine I was seeing her through her dead eyes, like looking up from the bottom of a pool. No one wants to be remembered for their deaths, or rather, I don't. So why do I remember it and remember it? I think I did everything right. Someone told me that I should have told her all the things she had done to hurt me before she died. But I didn't. Still, I lost her face. Months later, when we went on our first date, I tried to seem put together. I wore a shawl she had given me and her ring. I thought everything was behind me, death and dying and sickness. I didn't know I was changing my life, that I would have done anything, that what was left of me would become so ruthless to survive. Just a cheery poem, just to lighten the mood. All right, so I think that was six poems, so two more. I might have lost count. I am a poet. This poem was recently selected by Ted Kooser, who was the poet laureate from 2004 to 2006, and he has a column called This American Life in Poetry, and this should be, it's in the newsletter now, but it's not online, so it's in two columns. This will be in here. What it looks like to us and the words we use. All these great barns out here in the outskirts, black creosote boards knee-deep in the bluegrass, they look so artfully abandoned, even in use. You say they look like arks after the seas dried up. I say they look like pirate ships. And I think of that walk in my valley where Jay said, "You don't believe in God?" And I said, "No. I believe in this connection we all have to each other, to nature, to the universe." And she said, "Yeah, God." And how we stood there, low beasts among the white oaks, Spanish moss and spider webs, obsidian shards stuck in our pockets, woodpecker flurry, and I refused to call it so. So instead, we looked up at the unruly sky, its clouds in simple animal shapes we could name, though we knew they were really just clouds, disorderly and marvelous and ours. So, this last poem was actually just chosen by a science fiction writer to begin her novel, which apparently... She says this poem is exactly what happens in the book, which is very bizarre to me. And I'm going to actually tell the story, which makes me hard to read. But I've been reading with Adam Clay on tour for a long time, and I was reading this poem because it came out on poets.org, the poem a day. And I'd been reading for a while. We were at a bar in Fort Worth, Texas, and Adam says... okay, so what do you call that animal that has a black band over its eyes and it's like a, you know, hangs out in the trash can? And I said, a raccoon. And he said, no, it's a raccoon. And you make it sound like elegant and French. She's like, but they're dirty, nasty little creatures. And only you would make them sound like this French animal that, anyway, so now that I've said that, there's no way I'm going to be able to read this. But this is a love poem. This is for Lucas, who's at home working right now. The conditional. Say tomorrow doesn't come. Say the moon becomes an icy pit. Say the sweet gum tree is petrified. Say the sun's a foul black tire fire. Say the owl's eyes are pinpricks. Say the raccoon's a hot tar stain. Say the shirt's plastic ditch litter. Say the kitchen's a cow's corpse. Say we never get to see it. Bright future, stuck like a bum star, never coming close, never dazzling. Say we never meet her, never him. Say we spend our last moments together, staring at each other, hands knotted, clutching the dog, watching the sky burn. Say it doesn't matter. Say that would be enough. Say you'd still want this. Us, alive, right here, feeling lucky. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.